Since yesterday, I've been thinking about Lauren's question that she asked yesterday. Is there ever any mention of compassion in this practice? Or is there an aspect of compassion? I was thinking about it, how best to address that question, asking myself that question, although I have many answers for it, and I offered an answer yesterday, but I am rarely satisfied with the answers that I provide for questions that people ask. In fact, probably never. I am never satisfied. Exactly. That's true. And also because the questions are alive and the answers are, if there is a satisfactory answer, there's something dead about it. Everything is always open-ended, let's say. So I'm not sure how to approach this question, apart from to tell you some stories, tell you my experience, which is what I do every day. And I'm not telling you anything that I have learned in a book or that I have memorized or someone has told me. Everything I tell you is my experience. So I wanted to start with a story from my experience. Some years ago, as I was leaving a retreat in England, I was a young practitioner then, and I was with a few other people from the retreat, and we were on the train going to London. And it was early on a weekday morning, and it so happened that the other people on the train, most of them were going to work. We had been in the kind of community where people lived far from the city, but close enough so that they could go into London and work every morning. And with my fellow comrades from the retreat, we were all feeling very good, happy, laughing, enjoying one another, and not really paying much attention to anyone else. We weren't even paying attention to the fact that we weren't paying attention to anyone else. For some reason, at some point, I looked up and looked at all of the people around, and many of them were standing because all of the seats were taken. It was very crowded. And I was overcome by the sense that they all looked uncomfortable. And my first thought was, their clothes don't fit right, or they have clothes that are fabric that isn't soft, or something was uncomfortable about their clothing. It was something that I could recognize. I knew that a discomfort like that, when you have pants that scratch, or shoes that are too tight, or the tag on the back of your shirt is itching, I know that discomfort very well. And there's only one thing, you want it to end. And you become obsessed with it. and it becomes worse than it was if you hadn't even been thinking about it. The pants itch much more, and it starts spreading. And that tag is really more and more annoying. I recognized it. And I looked at these people and I thought, why are they uncomfortable? Why are they wearing clothes that don't fit right? And then I quickly went back to my friends and laughter. And then when I got to the train station and left my friends, it occurred to me that it wasn't about the clothing. And that I had turned away from it and gone back to my friends because I didn't want to know about it, the discomfort. Now, I was in what I call my prophet of bliss stage, where everything was blissful and I wanted to tell everyone about it and travel the earth and tell everyone about it. So my first thought was to go to these people and say to them, why are you unhappy? Don't be unhappy. The world is beautiful. Everything's perfect. If I had had flowers, I would have gone to them and put flowers around their necks, all of them, at Heathrow Airport. Fortunately, I did not do that. I probably would have been taken away somewhere had I done that. I realized as time went on that what I had seen was this basic, what in this Buddhist teaching we call the basic suffering of life. It's nothing dramatic. When we hear this, sometimes we think, oh, God, oh, basic suffering of life, life is suffering. It's not like that. It's just as if your clothes don't fit quite right. There's something indescribable that sometimes can be extreme. You can be extremely upset, sad, disappointed, frustrated. Sometimes it can be very pronounced. Sometimes you don't even notice it. You're not paying attention. You've learned how to not pay attention to it, to go back to the laughter, or to tell yourself that it's nothing. As a child, your parents already told you, no, 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 it's nothing, it's nothing. You learned very quickly not pay attention to it. But it's there, and it comes back in ways when we don't even expect it. It's like the fly buzzing. Sometimes we don't notice it, sometimes it stops, but then it starts again.
Yeah.
That's our story. That's our story. And it's not a fly, actually.
It's a huge.
Yeah. But that's exactly our story. We want to get out, but we don't know how. We want to get rid of this clothing that doesn't fit, but we don't know how. And sometimes we pretend that we don't want to get out. Sometimes we look for the exits in all the wrong places. Sometimes we try building a different cage. Maybe if it is gold, the cage will be better. Maybe if the car is a convertible, it will be better. If the car goes faster. If the husband is more handsome. We laugh, but this is absolutely what we do. In this practice, to come back to the original question. What we learn by this sitting is to be present beyond our likes and dislikes. So, beyond I like this room or I don't, beyond I wish she would ring the bell or I wish she wouldn't ring the bell, or beyond that's really annoying or I don't even notice it, he can do whatever he wants. We just learn to be present to whatever it is. Sometimes it's not difficult. Sometimes it's very difficult. It becomes most difficult when it's things we don't like. Either the discomfort, pain, suffering, or the things we like are leaving, are getting away from us. They don't stay. Which also creates some sort of discomfort. Displeasure. We just sit with it. We just sit here. And then we stand up. And we take a step forward. I would say this sitting, learning to be present beyond the likes and dislikes, is learning to be compassionate with myself. Learning to, I recognize that pain. I know that pain. I see that I would like to keep things as they are. I would like to control things. I would like to never be hungry. I would like to always have my favorite food. I recognize that. And I just sit with it. And then when I stand up and take a step forward, I can learn to be present with, beyond my dislikes and likes, with others in the world. And this is to learn compassion and express compassion with others in action. There is a lot of misunderstanding about Zen practice in general. Not only, there's misunderstandings about an unlimited amount of things in the world. Mostly we misunderstand when we are fixed to our ideas and opinions, our likes and dislikes. One of the basic misunderstandings about the Zen practice is that it's negative or nihilistic. In fact, it's the opposite. It's affirmative. It affirms the whole of life. To be present beyond dislikes and likes is just to affirm the whole of life. Be present to all of it. Acknowledge all of it. As I was sitting here during the 30 minutes before, I was listening to the building, the cracking of the, I think it's the roof, and I was so moved by that. The effort and the willingness and the total, the building gives itself to us entirely. And we could hear it giving itself. I was so moved by that, by this building giving itself to us. We can hear it. And it expects nothing in return. It's asking us for nothing. And if we can be present to that, just receive it, we probably will treat the building differently than if we don't hear that. And all of us in these 3 days have learned in one way or another, you may not even realize it, to be present beyond likes and dislikes. And it's obvious, it manifests in any number of different ways. I was sitting there having tea before I came to sit. And there was Nuno scrubbing the covers of the trash bins entirely. There was no gap. He just was cleaning those things thoroughly. I don't know what was going through his head. It doesn't matter. He was beautifully showing an act of compassion. He was putting into action what he has been doing here for 3 days. And then Marlene comes walking along with this basket of aromatic herbs that she had been able to pick and take thanks to Yvonne, who grows them, knows about them, cultivates them, and had shared her experience.
Yvonne would pick them.
Oh, okay. And was able to share them with her. Now, what Marlene will do with them, I don't know. But I'm sure it's not just for herself. Maybe it will be for Tozet too, I don't know. Or for other people too, I don't know. But it doesn't matter so much. What was moving was the act. Without a gap, without a thought of I'm doing something good, or I am doing this. It's what we call in French gratuit. It's free. And then I go in the house, and the trash bins were a little confusing, and I didn't know where to put my tea bag. Tose was standing there in the same position as me, and he just took my tea bag and took care of it. I don't know what he did. But there also was no gap. It was just, that's what presented itself. He acted. Every one of you, I could cite an example. Every single one of you. Everyone, just by sitting, and fortunately, without you even knowing it. Because if you knew it, wouldn't be it. We learn to be present beyond dislikes and likes, just by sitting. And then the natural functioning of that is what we call compassion. And even our idea of compassion is not it. If you are at the beach and it's maybe it's in the winter time and so the water is cold and you have your clothes on and shoes and you're walking along the beach and there's a child who has wandered into the water and is in trouble. Probably you will not even think. You will not think the water's too cold, I'm not going in, I don't want to ruin my shoes. You don't even have time for that. You will act. This is an extreme situation. And so that's an easy one. We don't have to really think about it. Every moment, though, is like that. In each moment, we have an opportunity to function in that same way. Nothing dramatic. It starts here. It starts with compassion here. As the Dalai Lama says, disarmament begins with disarming ourself first. So before the Americans do away with their nuclear bombs, individuals have to disarm. Otherwise, there will be no disarmament. And the same is true for every moment. Now, in this, very specifically in this Zen tradition, in fact, in most Zen traditions and in also some other Buddhist traditions, we have what we call the four vows, which are the basic. We don't do it here because I haven't translated. Well, we've translated it, but I'm not satisfied, into Portuguese, and because the context has not been appropriate to chant them. But usually, in this practice, after a sitting period, or at the end of the evening, at the last period, we would all together chant these vows. And they are what is called the bodhisattva vows. A bodhisattva is someone who hears, sees, feels, experiences the cries of the world, the pain, the suffering, the discomfort, and acts in order to relieve that. And acts beyond his or her personal likes and dislikes. The bodhisattva does not act because he thinks it's good, because he likes it, or because he dislikes it and he thinks he should. It's beyond that, or it's deeper than that, let's say. So the bodhisattva is someone who is always letting the others go ahead. It's the equivalent of someone takes my tea bag and takes care of it, so I can go ahead. So these four vows, which I have talked about before, so some of you have heard these before. The first one is, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Sentient beings are human beings, living beings. Not only human, but it includes human beings, living beings. It says they are numberless, meaning too many to count. Can't be counted. And I vow to save them. This raises a lot of questions, right? The first thing when we hear this, usually we say, well, that's impossible. That's absurd. If they're numberless, how can I possibly save them all? What does it mean to save? That's absurd as well, we could say. Who am I to save anybody? We make this vow, as I was saying yesterday about the rituals, even though it's incomprehensible, even though it defies logic. Zen, the very notion of Zen, defies logic. It cannot be defined. It's not a school, it's not a doctrine, it's not a religion, it's not a belief, it's not a philosophy. So already, forget anything. We can't understand it. And the first vow in this practice is also incomprehensible. living beings are, I can't even count them all, and I'm going to save them. Often I tell the story with this vow of, which it's a story that appears in other traditions as well, where there is a beach on which hundreds of starfish have washed up. The tide has gone out and they've been stranded on the beach. And a child comes along with a small pail and is filling the pail with a few starfish and carrying them into the water, dumping them into the water. Going back and forth doing this. An adult comes along and, as adults do, has a very logical point of view and says to the child, "What are you doing?" The child says, "Well, I'm saving starfish, putting them back in the water. If I don't, they will die." And the adult laughs. "Don't waste your time. You can't possibly save all these starfish with your little pail going back and forth like this." And the child says, "Oh, maybe. But for the one that I take and put in the water, it makes all the difference in the world. It's a difference between life and death." That's how we approach this vow. We recognize that they're numberless. It's endless. All we need to pay attention to is right now. Be present right now, beyond my likes and dislikes, beyond my opinions, my logic, my intellectual philosophies and notions and ideas. What right now? What needs to be done at this moment? The next vow is, desires are inexhaustible. We know this one, right? I vow to put an end to them. This one too raises a lot of questions and controversy and rejection, and leads to one of the basic misunderstandings about Zen. This is not about extinguishing desire. This is not about shutting off, becoming inhuman, cold, no feelings. It's the opposite. It's recognizing this constant explosion of desire. Which cannot be exhausted. Which it's like a source, a spring, it's constantly springing forth. And that's an expression of life. If we didn't have that source, then we would not be alive. There's nothing wrong with the desires. This vow is not saying get rid of desires. What it's saying is, I'm putting an end to the desire to constantly satisfy the desires, which is expressed by attachment, by clinging. I cling to the desire. I have this desire and I want it. And I want it satisfied now. All this is saying is, I recognize the desires. I allow them to be. I'm putting an end to their to the control that they have over my life, let's say. I am vowing to be present to the desires, with the desires, beyond my likes and dislikes, beyond wanting to have them satisfied, beyond wanting them not to be satisfied, just present to them. Another story from the Dalai Lama, who tells great stories as well. He was giving a conference in Los Angeles, and it was several days. And Los Angeles is a place where you have to drive long distances to get anywhere. So it was long from his hotel to the conference center. Every day he would go back and forth, and along the street were many shops. America is full of shopping, consuming, which also desire, exactly. And many of these shops were electronic shops, and the Dalai Lama loves electronics. And he loves radios as a child, the famous story is he loved to take apart radios and put them back together again. Watches, airplanes, mechanics, he loves this kind of thing. The mind. And he realized after a few days that as he was driving past these shops and seeing all these electronics in the windows, he wanted those things. He wanted all of those appliances, all of that equipment. It's like I've been looking at that vehicle there under the roof, and I've been wondering, is that a lawnmower? Is that? I've been intrigued at certain moments, wondering what it is and how it works and what kind of sound it makes. And I didn't necessarily want it, but I was interested in it. Well, the Dalai Lama wanted these things. And then he realized he didn't even know what they were. Most of them. He didn't even know what that appliance was, and he wanted it. This is desire. This is how it works. We want what we don't have, usually. We maybe want a car, okay, but then we want our neighbor's car. It's better than mine. This vow is putting an end to them in the sense of just acknowledging them. The Dalai Lama put an end to those desires by just acknowledging them and realizing he didn't even know what those things were. He didn't need to have them, but he acknowledged that he wanted them. And he didn't need to act on it and go buy them. Or ask, if he had asked for them, someone I'm sure would have bought him everything in the store and given it to him. He didn't need to. He just acknowledged that they were there. The third vow is, reality is boundless. I vow to see it. Again, if something is boundless, how can I see it? How can reality that is boundless, how can I see it? I'm vowing, I'm engaging myself in something that I'm not going to be able to do. This is how my logic is going. It's not saying, usually we think of seeing something as seeing the boundaries, and then we can close it in and understand it. That's not what this is saying. Again, this is a compassionate act of acknowledging, I cannot see the end of it. It's boundless. I can't see the boundaries. There are no boundaries. And I vow to see that. How do I see that? I sit and I learn to be present beyond the likes and the dislikes. I see the boundless reality here first. I see that I am not limited to what I think I am. I've been looking around here at the trying to figure out where the boundaries of this property are. I have no clue. And it doesn't matter. It feels like it's all ours, in the sense that we've been offered this space for these 3 days, and there's no borders. And it doesn't mean that we have to go out and look for the borders and push to the edge and use all of it. We're already using all of it. It's all here. I see that I am not limited, and I look out, and then because I have seen that here, I see that in each and every one of us. I see the potential in everyone. Again, the Dalai Lama, who in some of his darkest moments said, even Mao, who had certainly done some nasty things to the Dalai Lama and his people, the Dalai Lama said, even Mao has Buddha nature and has the potential to realize it and can and will realize it. This was, if we can really realize what he was saying, was that Mao is not limited to whatever acts he committed, whatever beliefs he had, whatever positions he took and held, that what we call Buddha nature, which is just the essence, the true nature in all of us, is not limited, it's boundless. It doesn't only manifest in good people. It doesn't only exist in beautiful flowers. It's beyond likes and dislikes. Boundless. So by vowing to see that, I am vowing to let go of my limited views, my attachments to my little space and my little reference points. I acknowledge them. They are part of the boundless reality. But I am vowing to not be stuck there, to take a step forward again and go beyond that. The last one is, the Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Again, full of questions and doubts. The Buddha way, Buddha means awakened. Awakened means it's as if we have been living with, there's a veil in front of our eyes, and suddenly we see things as they are. If we can be present beyond our likes and dislikes, then we can see things as they are. So the Buddha way is just the way in which we aspire to that, to see things as they are. And when we say it's unsurpassable, it doesn't mean it's not a question of better. It's not a question of this way is better than that way. It's not a judgment. It's unsurpassable in the sense that it's just what is. There's nothing above it. There's nothing below it. There's nothing on either side of it. It's just what is. I vow to embody that. That way cannot be lived any other way than you. It's not something that can be read about, thought about, talked about, although here I am sitting here talking about it day after day. It has to be embodied. There is no other way. And I vow to do that. I vow to embody it. This Zen teaching, I use these two words to sort of group together something that has no limits. It unfolds like a fan, right? You know what a fan is that unfolds? Is it?
A fan is like
a nevantai. What do you call that? And it unfolds, right? It's like this, and then it unfolds. So, this practice, it unfolds like that. And the more we sit and become present, the more it unfolds. And the more it unfolds, the more the many dimensions of life unfold. And in each of those dimensions of life, this practice is alive. This is the compassionate aspect. Maybe it starts just here with me like this, and then I stand up and it begins to unfold. And the more I become present, the more I look around and just see things as they are, the more alive suddenly it is, and the more I act just in accordance with the situation and what needs to be done, what arises before me. That's what these vows are talking about. And these vows are not just something that we use within a formal context. To bring this practice into my everyday life, I live in these vows. Which means that I'm living my everyday life present beyond my personal desires and likes and dislikes. I acknowledge them. As I was saying yesterday, I acknowledge fully that I have these personal dislikes and dislikes, and there are certain kinds of cheese I like and others I don't. Certain films I like, others I don't. I would like to sleep sometimes, and sometimes I can't, and I'm not happy. I acknowledge that. But these vows come from somewhere deeper than that, than those opinions, likes, and dislikes. And the more that we sit and learn to be present, the more that we realize that sitting is just about learning to be exactly who I am. Nothing else, nothing extra, nothing missing, just this. Which frees me, therefore, to then see others just as they are, and to welcome them all, and just see the building just as it is, and to welcome it. The fly just as it is, and to welcome it. The flowers. This My group is called the Wildflower Sangha. Because it just grows and grows. Practice is not limited to one place, one person, one language, one situation. It's everywhere, every moment. Unstoppable. And just gives and gives and gives. Like wildflowers. To come back to this notion of sitting, one is to realize that I am just exactly who I am. There is a Zen story in which a monk whose name was Basho, who became a teacher himself, a master himself, was sitting very diligently, practicing very diligently, and his teacher came along and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm sitting so that I can become a Buddha, so that I can become awakened." His teacher didn't say anything and picked up on the ground next to him. There was a tile, you know, like a tile like a, you have on the roofs. He started polishing it. And Basso looked at him and he said, "What are you doing?" And his teacher said, "Oh, I'm polishing this tile so it will become a mirror." And Basso said, "That's ridiculous. That tile can never become a mirror, no matter how much you polish it." And the teacher said, "It's like you trying to become a Buddha by sitting. As long as we have this idea that we will become something, that sitting will bring us something, that we will accomplish, arrive, obtain, we're missing the point. And then we don't do it usually, because it doesn't happen. So we say, oh, I'm not going to go sit now. It's worthless. I'm not becoming anyone else. Forget it. I'm tired. I'd prefer to sleep. Read a book, have some coffee, go to a movie, talk with my friends." Which is fine, because that's acknowledging the truth. It's not going to do what you think it will. So it's better to go have a cup of coffee, in fact, because you won't be satisfied. It won't happen. What does happen is, if you can stay present, just do it without being caught by your likes and dislikes. I like this. I'm accomplishing something. I don't like this. I'm not accomplishing something. If you can just sit with that, not deny it, sit with it, be present to it, as if including it all, what happens is you realize exactly who you are. I told you yesterday that my friend's name is Joie Partagée, right? Shared joy. My name that my teacher gave me at the same time as her is Tu es cela. You are that. Not I am that. You are that. This is an ancient, again, a name that predates Buddhism. Yeah. And it's a constant challenge for me, this name. A challenge in the sense that, as I was talking about koans, these things that you can't resolve with your intellect, that's what this is for me. I know, and the reason my teacher gave me this name is I know that. My experience is that. My experience is you are that. At the same time, it's like these vows. It's ungraspable. It's not conceptual. It's not intellectual. It can't be understood. It can only be experienced. And it's the very basic experience of this practice. You realize exactly who you are. And it will not be your ideas about who you are. And I know that the basic suffering, what I described as the clothes being not fitting right, is because we don't realize that. We don't realize exactly who we are, and so we suffer. It's true, the clothes don't fit right. We feel like we're in someone else's clothes because we don't realize exactly who we are. Throughout these generations and generations, ages and ages, in my lineage, but not only, hundreds, thousands, millions of people have realized exactly who they are, and because of that, have turned and spoken and showed other people the way, how they can realize that. This is the expression, the compassionate expression of the wisdom. In another Zen story, there were two brothers, we would say, two comrades in practice who had been in a monastery together, had the same teacher, gone through years and years of struggle and joy and whatever. And one had realized exactly who he was. I'm just using that as a formula. Something had happened for him. The other one not. And the other one was desperate. And he said to his friend, I'm going off. I have to get to the bottom of this. I have to discover this. But I would really like you to come with me. He was leaving the monastery to go off on it, as was traditional at that time in China, in what's called the golden age of Zen. Eighth, ninth century, and went off to make a pilgrimage, which meant basically just wandering around and stopping in monasteries from time to time, listening to different teachers. And he asked his friend to come with him. And his friend said, well, okay, I don't really want to, but I will. I don't know if he said this, but I can imagine that this is what he was thinking. I will go beyond my likes and dislikes and my preferences. I will accompany him. And he said, okay, I will go with you. However, I can walk with you. But there are a few things that you have to accept and that I cannot do for you. His friend said, okay, what are they? He said, I can't carry your bones and your muscles and your flesh, your hair, your eyebrows. You have to carry that yourself. He said, okay, that's fine, I can do that. And he said, I can't eat for you. You have to eat for yourself. Okay. I can do that. He said, I can't go to the toilet for you. And you have to do that yourself. So I said, yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. He said, I can't sleep for you. You have to do that yourself. His friend said, okay, that's fine. Okay, let's go. Now his friend had still not realized what was being said to him. And so the two were called Seppo and Ganto, the sort of famous characters in Zen literature. And Seppo was the one who was going off on the journey and wanted Ganto to come with him. So Seppo didn't really still hear what Ganto was saying to him, that you have to be who you are yourself. I can't do that for you. And Seppo knew that. Ganto knew that Seppo didn't hear it. And he accepted to go with him anyway. And he went with him for that reason. He accompanied him for that reason. Because he knew himself, Ganto. He had had the same experience. And he knew the best thing he could do. He had taken this vow, these vows. What needed to be done was to accompany him, go with him on the path, as far as he could. Accompany him, do for him what he could, but ultimately knowing only he could be him. Zen literature is full of these stories. So when we ask the question about compassion in Zen, it's everywhere. However, it's not, as with most things in Zen, which we call it the radical direct approach, as opposed to some other Buddhist practices, which are gradual. Zen just goes right to the point and doesn't bother with dwelling upon different aspects, which is not always... Okay. Where did you stop?
I would like to get some of the...
From which point did you lose it?
No, I condensated what you said.
About the direct?
On that, no, on that part, yes.
The direct approach, not as opposed to the gradual. And this is really to simplify, because Zen is also gradual, and the gradual approaches are also direct. So neither one is fixed anywhere. However, in Zen practice, we maybe don't take a specific active act or a specific aspect of the practice and say, this is compassion, and we will focus on this. This is wisdom, and we will focus on this. Whereas in other practices, we might do more of that. That has qualities, and also there are good things about that and bad things about that. And sometimes in the Zen stories, for reasons that are cultural, what is actually a compassionate act appears to us as strange or abusive or cruel. And one of those stories is, again, from this golden age. There was a teacher whose name was Gute, and his teaching whenever someone would ask him, what is the essential teaching? What is the essence of Zen? He would hold up a finger. One. Just this. Oneness. And he attracted quite a following. I won't go into the story of how he came to that, what his path was, but he came to that because that was his experience. It wasn't some gimmick that he created. This was his experience. And he had a boy who was his attendant, maybe 15, 14, a young monk, who attended him and spent hours with him and served him and was with him all the time. And so knew his teaching very well. And one time he was a visitor at the monastery, some sort of noble person or some dignitary, an official of some sort, and he asked the boy, so what is Gute's teaching? What is your master's teaching? And the boy held up his finger. And the master heard about this and called the boy in. And he said, So, what is my teaching? And do you know the story? No? And the boy held up his finger. And Gute cut off his finger. And the boy ran screaming to the door, holding what was left of his finger, and just at the moment when he was about to go out the door, the teacher called his name. I don't know what his name is. Pedro. And the boy turned, and at that moment he got it. You're probably thinking, what? What did he get? We use this is one of our koans. What did he get? What did he understand? What did he experience at that moment? What was compassionate about that teacher's action of cutting off the finger? What?
He lived to stand in the prison.
He liberated himself in prison.
That in our day, the master will be in the prison.
No. What? In our day, the master will be what?
Will be arrested.
Ah, yes, exactly. Would go to prison. Yes, exactly. Different cultural context, right? And maybe even in these stories, sometimes what happens is metaphorical. Yeah, we don't know, actually. But it's very possible that in that, you know, think what was going on in Europe in the 9th century. You know, it wasn't exactly what we would consider refined. Why was that a compassionate act? What was the teacher trying to show him? What was the teacher's intention by cutting off his finger?
He was only repeating.
Okay. It's like the Buddha story.
He was only repeating. And the point is not repeating.
It wasn't his way.
Exactly.
But human beings function by imitating the others.
Yeah. And at some point, we have to let go of that, because that's how, as children, we learn. But we all walk in a different way. We all learn to walk and we learn to speak by imitating, that's true. But we all have a different voice and we all speak differently and we all use different words. And if we just repeated exactly what someone else was saying, we would be stuck. We would be dead. We would be suffering greatly. We wouldn't be able to express ourselves as we are. It's really an endless topic and subject. As I said yesterday, I was wearing a different one of these things yesterday. Today I have one that has the other saying on it, which addresses the question I'm looking at today. And this quote, it's not from what we would traditionally consider a Zen teacher. It's from Nisargadatta, who I consider a Zen teacher, although he is not from the Zen tradition. He's Indian, from the Advaita tradition. My teacher wrote this one, however, on the back. I didn't choose this quote. She gave me this, and she gave this to me for my 50th birthday, and wrote this on the back. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns. This really says it all. Mm-hmm. When I look inside here and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns. That's where my life happens. That's how my life unfolds. This comes back to yesterday what I was saying about if we fix in one or the other, if we deny one because we think we have to have the other. If I say I'm nothing and I don't see that I'm everything, my life can't turn. If I see that I'm everything, if I'm caught by everything, without seeing that I'm nothing, my life can't turn. And in fact, there is no wisdom without love, and there is no love without wisdom. The two go perfectly together. And so, the question of, and love, we can replace that with the word compassion, because that's what he's talking about. And so, about that. So when we say, I see that I am nothing, this means I have no fixed identity. I am not what I think I am. I am not this, I'm not an object. I am not my anger. There is anger, but that's not who I am. When we see exactly who we are, when we realize exactly who we are, that is to realize I am nothing. Not nothing in a nihilistic, negative, nothing exists. It's to see that I am not what I think I am.
Nothing, we can say it's an open space?
You could say that, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And open space is nothing. That's true.
But everything is fixed.
Space of opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Unlimited potential.
Yeah.
When I look outside and see that I am everything, and this naturally follows. If I look inside and I have realized that I am nothing, naturally when I look out, I will see that I am everything. That's the natural flowing of the wisdom. Because I am not this one thing that I think I am, I look out and I see that I'm everything. I'm everyone.
You don't feel loneliness.
You might, but you might recognize that the other is also lonely. And you share that loneliness. And therefore you're not alone. That's true. Again, it comes back to what I said yesterday about laughter as being shared joy, making us one. Pain serves the same function. Suffering serves the same function. Any emotion, any experience serves the same function. It's not just mine. This is boundless love. This is... reality is boundless, and it's nothing but love. Even when it's expressed as bombing the shit out of Afghanistan or Iraq. Yeah. This is an expression of, we could say, unsatisfied love. If we trace it back, this is a controversial statement, but if we look at it, it's true. I want, again, the Dalai Lama, I don't know why, I think because there's that picture of the Dalai Lama up there. It's very present this morning. I saw an interview with him on television. Just, it must have been like maybe November of 2001, or December maybe, December I think it was. So after the attacks in New York, and just after the Americans had started in Afghanistan their war. And it was on French television on this kind of interview program where the journalist is very funny and irreverent and kind of tries to ask questions that are tricky of famous people. And so here's the Dalai Lama sitting there. And so the guy says to him, "What would you have done if you were George Bush?"
Kill myself.
And the Dalai Lama just laughed. Like he does, you know. Dalai Lama with his ha. And the journalist sort of, there was one of those moments of what? And it seemed to me that it was a long moment, but maybe it was only a few seconds. I was thinking, what is he going to say to Dalai Lama? And after he laughed, he paused, and he said, "Well, I think it was interesting that he waited a month before he acted. Before he went and bombed Afghanistan, there was a period, it wasn't the next day, right? There was this, and there was actually a moment, a sort of pregnant moment in the world when it seemed like something else could happen. When it seemed like what had led those attacks in September to happen could suddenly lead to something positive, that the world could change in that moment. Suddenly the rest of the world was feeling compassion for the Americans. The Americans weren't feeling their usual arrogance and righteousness. Even George Bush seemed to be in a moment of doubt, of not knowing. And it was very palpable in the world at that time something else could happen. It didn't. The Americans and George Bush went back to their arrogance and their righteousness, and the rest of the world couldn't go along with it, and it led us to Afghanistan and Iraq and finally to Barack Obama, which we could say, okay, it did lead us to something positive, but we don't know.
Can I say negative? Well, you can see that time, the time that they had to organize the bombing.
It's true. It's true. And they were. It's true. It's true. However, at the same time, there was that sort of no solid ground moment. Their reaction in the back of their mind was to get the arms together. But there was also this moment of not solid ground. And what the Dalai Lama was pointing at was that also at the potential for that, no fixed points of reference that exists in every situation, and that the Dalai Lama cannot be anyone but the Dalai Lama. He cannot be George Bush. He could not answer that question any other way. He could not say what he would do if he were George Bush, because if he were George Bush, he wouldn't be George Bush. So,
I was meaning if he was president, of course. Not so.
But even that, he could not be president of the United States, the Dalai Lama. He could only be what he is. And he could only offer that statement at that moment in that context. He could not have given another response. The journalist had no clue, didn't get it, and moved on to something else, I think. I don't remember. That's the only thing that I remember from the interview. Because it was so telling and so amazing to see. The same thing is true for each of us in every moment. We could say George Bush couldn't have acted in any other way either. What Dalai Lama was pointing to was that even George Bush, even Mao Zedong, had that potential in that moment. And for a brief moment, it was manifest. And the same is true for all of us.
Well, I had conversations with people that live in war, in Angola, and it was 13, 14 years ago. No, 30, 40.
30.
And they didn't still forgot the war. They have anger inside. It's very, very strong.
Yep.
Perhaps stronger than, or same strong as Buddha nature.
It's not different, actually. It's an expression of it. And what happens is that when anger stays with us like that, when we hang on to it,
attachment.
It's an attachment, exactly. And then we suffer.
Yes, they suffer.
Yeah.
They have psychiatric problems.
Sure, absolutely. And we do the same thing if we hang on to love. And then we kill it, in fact. The same is the... Any clinging causes suffering.
Word is off.
Yeah, any clinging causes suffering. But when we realize exactly who we are, we include without clinging. We don't have to hang on to everything because we see everything is here. Okay, is it... Moonshine?
Yes, 2 minutes.